Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 77th episode of Source Material. I am your host, Jesse Starcher, and tonight I welcome back Benjamin J. Colon, and by his request, we have a great Spider-Man story to tell you about. Going way back to 1982, in Amazing Spider-Man 229 and 230, we find the first run-in Peter Parker has with the famous X-Men villain Juggernaut. Written by Roger Stern, drawn by John Romita Jr., and hailed as one of the best Spider-Man stories ever written, we find out in this episode just why it is pretty darn special to Benjamin. So sit back and listen as we discuss the great tale of Nothing Can Stop the Juggernaut. Spoiler warning, be prepared as we will be spoiling this book, so feel free to read it yourself prior to listening to the cast, or grab the book and follow along. Don't forget, you can follow me at Stiznarchy on Twitter and the show at SourceMatCast. Don't forget, you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio. Just search Rattlitch. Also, make sure to give the Rattlitch and Broadcasting Network Facebook page a like and stay up on top of all the great podcasts our network has to offer. All right, let's get to it. I haven't read any other stories in this Wizard Masterpiece edition, and it's so funny. Because right down there at the bottom, the 10 greatest Spider-Man stories ever told. And I remember you saying, that definitely sounds like Wizard. Because there's only five stories in this thing.
Right.
They tend to overblow things just a little bit, or to try and make it look like there's more content than what's actually there.
Yeah, that's them all over.
I used to collect Wizard, man.
So did I, but man, you know, after a while, you started. I don't know about anybody else, but after a while, I started being able to see through a lot of their crap.
Really?
Yeah. They were in a lot of people's pockets, and you know,
I never noticed that. Well, here's the thing: I think I started buying Wizard like right around issue 6. So that was when the inside was practically all black and white, and I don't know if you got anything color in a few of those issues. And then sometime, it was definitely right around the Image boom, or shortly therefore, right before, in the 90s. I mean, they really went all out. But my favorite thing was obviously those pinups that they had in each one. I always loved getting those and taking them to school and hanging them on my locker, inside my locker or whatever.
Yeah, that was cool. Like, you know, that did, not exactly the same thing, but, you know, there was usually, the new issue, whatever new issue came out, you know, friends and I would talk about it at school from time to time. It's just like you started noticing later on, you know, because they were all about Image Comics at first, especially, you know, the Wizard, I think, came out a little bit before Image was formed, but once they came out before. Once Image was the thing, you know, that was their bread and butter for so long. And then once a few of the Image guys kind of stopped kissing their ass, then, you know, then they were garbage and they were the enemy. And, you know, they never, you know, they didn't get the same covers that they used to. And when they did, it was not as favorable as it used to be.
Wizard stopped, I think, publication. What was it, mid-2000s or
something like that?
Yeah. There was a time I wasn't reading because I think I was in college and shortly thereafter got married and wasn't collecting comics, and I had nothing. I was more into Magic cards and playing Magic at that point in time. The library. I would go to the library and they would have an issue of Wizard sitting right there, the current issue of Wizard. You could just you could check out really old ones, but the current one you had to sit there and read at the library itself. So I maybe caught like two or three Wizards back in the early 2000s, but never really read anything after that. So I never really noticed half the stuff you were talking about.
You know, to be fair, I owe a lot to Wizard. Wizard put me on to, you know, to Watchmen and Dark Knight and all of that stuff. But
I remember you mentioning that.
Their focus was, you know, a little bit narrower than it could have been. They had tremendous influence in the comic book industry, and they really kind of wasted it.
Oh, that's unfortunate. Well, this Masterpiece edition, I never did look to see what the copyright was here. Boy, that small print. Man, I'm getting old. 2004. So they put this together in 2004. We have, of course, the one we're here to talk about tonight, Nothing Can Stop the Juggernaut. Amazing Spider-Man's 229 and 230.
Yep.
Hide and Seek, which apparently happens right after this. Amazing Spider-Man 231 and 232. Roger Stern and John Romita Jr.
I meant to read that too, just to, you know, just to see where it went afterwards. I just kind of ran out of time.
Yeah, I read the ones we're talking about, and I haven't had a chance to read anything else after this. But looking at the back here, the venomous cobra is after one of Spider-Man's reporter friends, but the hunter becomes the hunted when the monstrous Mr. Hyde, arrives on the scene with revenge on his mind, looking to settle an old score with his ex-serpentine partner. It's Hyde versus Cobra, and an everything goes supervillain brawl with Spidey caught in the middle. That's interesting. The Kid Who Collects Spider-Man. Very touching story from what I've heard. Never read it.
It's really, I think I mentioned it's only if like maybe a 10, 12 page backup story, but the actual comic that it takes place in, that's literally the only thing that anybody remembers about it. The main story of that comic is a pretty forgettable,
throwaway,
you know, story about with the, like the wrecking crew, which I think were, mostly villains in Thor comics, but they made some appearances in Spider-Man too. You know, probably not terrible, but you know, the Kid Who Collects Spider-Man is so well known and so kind of beloved that that's really what anybody gets that comic for. They sort of adapted it into the animated series.
Oh, did they really? Well, that's cool.
Yeah, they changed a few things and it played over the course of like I think two or three episodes, so they kind of padded it out, but the basic gist of it is pretty similar.
Okay. The fourth story, Death of Jean DeWolf, which took place in Spectacular Spider-Man 107 through 110.
I love that story.
Well, I've never even heard of Jean DeWolf. What is this?
At the time, she was a police captain that worked with Spider-Man closely. It's later found out, you know, he finds out kind of after the fact, after he investigates her murder, that she had kind of a thing for him. But it introduces the, you know, the serial killer called the Sin Eater. I don't give away too much because it's actually a pretty good story to cover.
Okay. That's fine. I'd definitely cover that at some point.
And at the very least, please read that story because it's outstanding.
Okay. Peter David.
It's one of those, really makes me kind of sad that Peter David did not write more Spider-Man. I mean, he wrote a good amount, but he could have, like, I really wish he had a good long run on Spider-Man because he's really good. Which is funny because he's not known for, like, dark stories, and that's one of the darker Spider-Man stories and considered one of the better ones. Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny how that works out. Same thing with, like, Kraven's Last Hunt. That's, you know, so well known, and everybody, a lot of people consider it the best Spider-Man story ever. Mm-hmm. I don't. I love it. It's a good story. I don't consider it the best, but it's sort of unusual.
Oh, it's that ending. It's the ending of that story that gets everybody. Now, the final story is one that I know I probably had the chance to read, and that was Venom Strikes Back, Amazing Spider-Man 315 through 317.
Yep.
David Michelinie, Todd McFarlane. And of course, you got that iconic Venom with all the teeth going all the way up to his ears. great looking stuff.
That is that's the second Venom story that they did. That's the second like ever Venom story.
Yeah, I was going to say I remember seeing that cover, and I think that might be one that I own.
The one where he's standing over Spider-Man, like knocked out. Spider-Man's like on his back, and Venom standing over him.
Let me see, 213. I think you're right because it's the picture on the back's just showing his face.
Dude, we're gonna I'm gonna have more than one convention story tonight because there's a convention story behind that comic, and I actually have it and have it signed by McFarlane.
Oh, nice.
But that was because like I found out at literally the last possible second that McFarlane was doing a panel a signing at the Image booth at New York Comic Con, like literally like 2 aisles away from my table.
Yes.
And a friend of mine told me about it, and I didn't have anything for him to sign, so I ran across the convention hall and found, I had to get something, and I found that comic and came back and, like, jumped on the line to get it signed real quick.
Awesome. I'm looking at, they don't have the cover, is what's strange. They've got 317, there's 316. 316 is the one, yeah, just like you're talking about, where Spider-Man's out, and Venom's got his hand, like he's reaching, almost going to reach for his throat or something. What is 315? 315 is...
315, here's the thing, and a lot of Spider-Man writers do this, and generally a lot of good Marvel writers did this, especially in the 80s and 90s, which was basically, and Stan Lee perfected this, so it's usually them, you know, doing what he did. Stan Lee was kind of the master of wrapping up one story and starting another one in literally the same issue.
Okay.
So that, what was it, 315 was the
yes.
first part?
Yeah.
That's most of that is the end of like a throwaway Hydro Man story, sort of a subplot with Peter and the folks that he this was during a time when he was like kicked out of his apartment and he was living back with his aunt, and this was not too long after the marriage, and him and Mary Jane were living with his aunt, and she had started a boarding house, and there were all kinds of wacky characters and, you know, involved in that. So there was a subplot going on with that. Very little of that issue has to do with Venom. That's where it starts, and it's basically kind of follows him breaking out of prison and making his way back to New York.
Okay. I have that Hydro Man issue. That's the one that I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
And that's probably exactly what you're talking about there. It's the back end of it, so they're not showing the cover. I imagine because, if I remember correctly, Hydro Man's on the front, and then down in the tiny little corner, it has a little picture of Venom, or a picture of Eddie, or something, you know, half Eddie, half Venom, or something like that. Or maybe it's Venom altogether. Right. So, okay. All right, gotcha.
Yeah, that's the one.
All right. Well, let's go ahead. We'll get into the story here. Nothing can stop the Juggernaut. The Amazing Spider-Man, number 229, number 230. Let's go ahead. We'll talk real quick as to why. This was one of the ones that you came to me and you said, I want to cover this. And I know it definitely, the time frame that we're releasing this has some significance. And also, the story has some significance.
A couple of reasons. Aside from the fact that it's, you know, considered one of the best Spider-Man stories ever, it's a pretty simple and straightforward story, as we're going to find out. But it touches a lot of important points about Spider-Man and who he is and what he's about. When, you know, I knew about this comic for a while. When I was a guest on another podcast, Made a Fail podcast, some good friends of mine. Hi, Dana. Hi, George.
What's up, guys?
We were talking about Spider-Man. This was a couple of years ago, and they mentioned one of the hosts, George. He mentioned he actually has the Spider-Man comic from the month and year he was born. And I thought that's pretty interesting. I wonder what, you know. So I decided to look it up and wonder what the Spider-Man comic. It seems like something that I should have, being such a gigantic Spider-Man fan. It never really occurred to me to do that. So I decided, okay, well, let me look up and see what Spider-Man comic came out the month and year that I was born. And I looked it up, and it was part two of Nothing Can Stop the Juggernaut, which came out, and this is where everybody who cares to can do the math. It came out in July of 1982.
That's right.
So, yeah, I've got a birthday coming up.
Awesome stuff. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you. Try not to think too much about it.
We're all getting old, man. There's no stopping it. Trust me.
Yeah, I know. I'm making peace with it. But then I realized, like, not only was this a great Spider-Man story that actually came out, you know, when I was born, it was also drawn by one of my favorite artists, John Romita Jr.
Yes.
Fairly early in his run, we're going to see another character in the story, Madame Web, who first appearance was in Amazing Spider-Man number 210, mm-hmm. which is the very first issue that John Romita drew for Amazing Spider-Man. This was the beginning of his run. I've got that comic in front of me, too. I decided to kind of flip through it and get some a little bit of backstory there, too, just in case. I guess this is where I tell the other story about what this comic has come to mean to me.
Yeah.
This was about 3 years ago at New York Comic Con in 2013, and it's always a hell of a thing because I try to do my best. I'm an exhibitor. I have my own comic. I produce my own comic. I am 99% of the time, well, not 99% of the time, but I try as much as I possibly can to be responsible at New York Comic Con and to be there to work. You know, I'm there to promote my comic, and I'm there
to meet
people.
As much fun as going on around you, you've got to focus.
Yeah, and sometimes I do a better job of that than others. You know, I have very good friends that help me out every year. You know, you guys know who you are.
that, you know, are good about, if I don't tear myself away from the table to go and have some fun, you know, they'll tell me, they'll literally, like, kick me out of the table at some point or another and be like, go and, you know, come back in a little while and we'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually when somebody comes to buy something. I think I'm, you know, I'm scaring customers away, actually. I can't prove that, but it sort of works out that way. The point is... That year, you know, I tried to meet some people and meet some comics pros, as I always do at every convention I go to, whether I have a table or not.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the, you know, that was one of the Stan Lee years. There was a ridiculous story behind that. We can get to that another time. I got so many convention stories, I don't want to tell them all at once. I may have told you this story before, I can't remember, but that was one of the most ridiculous signings I've ever been to, and it almost turned into a riot.
Wow. No, I don't know if I don't know if I've ever heard that one or not, but I look forward to hearing that at some point. That's awesome.
Well, later that same day was the only time that weekend that John Romita Jr. was going to be there, and he was going to be signing.
Uh-huh.
He was actually late. You know, it's New York City. It's, you know, west side of Manhattan. Getting there on foot, which is how I get there, is hard enough. Getting there by car it's got to be a nightmare, especially on the weekend, especially when there's an event going on. And there's usually multiple events going on in that part of Manhattan at all times. So, you know, he was running late. He got there. He was extremely apologetic about it. At first, there were the organizers kind of set a limit on, you know, how many things you can get signed and all that stuff. When he got there, he basically just, you know, started signing everybody's stuff. And no matter what anybody had, no matter how much stuff everybody had, he went through all of it. And he signed for everybody that was in attendance. This is not the first time that I met him. I've met him a couple of times before. John Romita Jr. is actually, like, you know, he's not just my favorite artist because I like his comics. And because I personally like his work ethic. He's also one of the nicest people I've ever met that worked in the comic business. That's important for me to say. And they say, you know, you should never meet your heroes, but I've kind of been fortunate enough that, you know, the people that I look up to in the profession that I'm, you know, striving to get some kind of hold in, they're all, at the very, very least, they're all at least courteous, if not outright, like, awesome. John Romita Jr. is one of those guys that, like, he will do his best to make you feel, you know, like you're appreciated, like he appreciates his fans.
Mm-hmm. That matters. That really does.
So I had these two issues of Amazing Spider-Man with me. And I told him, you know, when he was signing everything, I told him, I'm like, well, actually, you know, 230 actually came out, you know, the month and the year I was born. Like, I don't want to make you feel old or anything like that. But,
well, let me interrupt. Did he still look like he was in his 30s? Because this dude, if I remember right.
Yeah, he doesn't.
He doesn't age.
He's pushing 60, man. And
it's amazing.
I hope. Yeah. I hope
amazing.
I like that when I'm 60.
I hear you, dude.
He does that. Like, he'll try to have a conversation with you. He'll talk about, like, you know, art that he did. One time I brought Demon in a Bottle with to one signing, and he, like, tried to cover up the date and tried to guess, like, because he couldn't remember. He tried to guess which date the comic came out.
I
think he was off by a year.
Wow.
This time I told him this, you know, well, this comic came out the month and the year I was born. And he tells me, like, I was like, well, do you want me to write happy birthday on it? I'm like, yes, sure.
Please do.
Okay. And most of his comics, he signs with, he kind of initials. Every once in a while, he'll sign his full name. This, he wrote, you know, happy birthday, cheers, John Romita Jr.
Oh,
he wrote it out completely. It was one of the coolest experiences I've had at a convention with a pro. I tried not to be too, you know, to geek too much about it, but I geeked a little bit.
You marked out, man. I would have too. There would have been no stopping that mark out train for me, man. I would have been all hell yeah excited, dude. That's awesome.
He was joking with it too, like, because I kind of hesitated when I asked him, you know, when he asked me if I wanted happy birthday on, like, you know, because most of the time, not everybody wants their, you know, when they get stuff signed, not everybody wants it personalized, because, you know, a lot of times people get stuff signed with an eye towards, you know, flipping it later.
Yeah, they're going to flip it.
So, you know, you personalize something, and by the rules of like CGC and all that crap, just by virtue of getting it signed without a CGC witness, you've already rendered it worthless anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Which is exactly what he said. He's like, I'm already, you know, it's already worth, I already signed it. It's already worthless. You might as well.
That's the one that you sent to me in the messenger, right?
I did.
That's cool. That'll be on the slideshow. How long did it take you to find the book itself? I mean, was it a pretty big search or something you found pretty easily?
It was eBay, you know.
Was it?
Yeah. That part wasn't too difficult.
Okay.
I was able to get them both at the same time. And
awesome.
You know, that was cool because, like, otherwise, these are harder to find at conventions than they are to find online. So sometimes it works out that way.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and we'll get into, if you don't have anything else you want to share, we'll get into the story itself. I want to talk about the characters, mainly because we have Spider-Man, who I'm sure most people out there are pretty aware of who Spider-Man is, what his powers are, so we're not going to get into that.
I haven't a clue.
I didn't think so. I'm glad you're here. You might learn something, Benjamin.
Sure.
I guess maybe I could ask you this, and can you give us an idea of where Spider-Man's at in his life in these two comics? Because I understand, like, right at the beginning, they mentioned about him being a grad student. We're at Amazing Spider-Man 220-some. We're in the 80s, so Spider-Man's been around for more than, or, yeah, around, what, 20?
20 years.
20-some years at that point.
About 20 years.
Yeah. So, as a character, I mean, did you have any insight you'd like to share as to where Peter Parker / Spider-Man is when this story goes down?
For the most part, I don't want to say like where his character kind of plateaus. I don't know if that's necessarily the right way of saying it, but it's pretty familiar territory for people that know the basic idea of like who Peter Parker is and his sort of dual identity. You know, he's still taking photographs for the Daily Bugle. He's still a freelance photographer. He's a, you know, on the side, grad student. And, you know, he struggles with all of that sort of thing. That's kind of Spider-Man all over, no matter what, is sort of this, you know, balancing the, you know, the boring everyday life with being a superhero. The writer, Roger Stern, who wrote these two issues, it's funny because he's kind of I always get the feeling that he's kind of the patron saint of like how everybody remembers Spider-Man post Stan Lee.
Uh-huh.
He kind of took what Stan did in the 60s and just kind of brought it, you know, updated in such a way that, you know, there's a term that gets used a lot in Marvel sometimes that I don't necessarily like, and it's called the illusion of change. In this case, you know, Peter Parker is an adult. He's clearly not a high school kid anymore like he was when he first started out. He's aged in that way, but fundamentally his character's pretty similar to how it was in the 60s when Stan Lee was writing. Some of the trappings are different. Some of the characters and supporting characters and some of the subplots are a little bit different to kind of accommodate the fact that he's clearly an adult now. But the broad strokes of it are pretty similar. Whether or not that's necessarily the best thing for the character is something that, you know, Spider-Man fans have been debating for years, whether or not, you know, he should get older, whether or not, you know, just how much he should change as a character. That's probably not this is probably not the time or the place to have an argument that big.
Uh-huh.
But you see that here. You see, also another thing that Stan was known for that I mentioned a little earlier was, you know, subplots, and basically one story ends, another story kind of seamlessly begins. Roger Stern was really good at that, actually.
Uh-huh.
And he was really good at juggling all kinds of subplots, whether they had to do with Spider-Man and Peter Parker, and they'd kind of weave in and out. It's not too long after this that we start getting the first Hobgoblin stories. And
that's
the character that this team is best known for. They introduced the Hobgoblin and years worth of, you know, on and off stories dealing with that.
Relationship wise, that's one of the big things I picked up from, although it's not essential to this story in any way. I noticed that the mention of Black Cat, Felicia Hardy is here. He's not dating Mary Jane at this point in time. Is that right?
Well, that's another Roger Stern trademark, is that sort of rotating relationship triangle that he constantly was putting Peter into. So he had any number of women, you know, in and out of Peter's life during the time he was writing the comic. Mary Jane was one of them. She kind of was not directly in the picture at the time of the story. I know she comes back relatively soon after this.
Okay.
And Black Cat was, if I had to guess, I think Black Cat was actually really kind of a favorite of Roger Stern's. He really loved, you know, playing that dynamic with her and Spider-Man. Yeah, so she's never too far away from the picture here.
Let's talk, before we get to the main villain, let's talk about the victim of this story, and that is one Madame Web. You already talked a little bit about how, you know, the first issue that she was in, which was Amazing Spider-Man 210. The real name, Cassandra Webb, by the way, just grabbing that off the Marvel Wiki.
She's introduced in the comics as sort of, you know, like a street corner psychic. At least that's how she's presented at first. Peter at first doesn't, you know, really take that too seriously. She gets caught up in some various like criminal dealings, and he kind of discovers her, you know, where she lives, her home, and finds that, you know, she's this blind woman hooked up to this gigantic mechanical, you know, high-tech life support system, but that she's also, you know, she's also legitimately a psychic. She can, you know, she can read minds to a certain degree. She can tell the future. She actually eventually, after he saves her life, she eventually, like, finds out his secret identity because she's psychic. She kind of uses him as, you know, for a while off and on as sort of her proxy, like, in the real world, you know, help out certain people and stop certain activities. That kind of circles back to this particular story because, you know, as we're about to talk about, the villains of this story kind of discover her powers and figure that, you know, she'd be the perfect person to use for their own purposes without really knowing fully about who she is and what she's about. That plays into the story directly in this first part.
Let's talk about the Juggernaut. What can you tell us about the Juggernaut here? This is the first, I know this is the first meeting between Spider-Man and the Juggernaut that we're about to talk about. Yeah, give us the lowdown on old Kane Marco.
Now, I know the bullet points about as far as the Juggernaut. I'm sure there are far bigger X-Men fans than I am that could probably go into much greater detail. I know Juggernaut, first of all, is related to Charles Xavier. I think he's his half-brother. But yeah, he basically gains his power from, I believe it's called the Amulet of Sidorak. It's this magical amulet that gives whoever holds it the power of, you know, human Juggernaut, which basically means it makes you freakishly huge, freakishly strong, and pretty much invincible. Nothing can hurt you. Nothing can kill you. We find out later on here he actually has this sort of mystical force field that protects him from harm.
Yeah, just about anything.
And we're going to see, yeah, trust me, that gets put to the test here in some of the best ways. Basically, Juggernaut's only friend in the world and his sort of partner in crime, which is Black Tom Cassidy,
mm-hmm.
sort of the brains of the operation. You know, Juggernaut obviously being the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one that kind of gets wise to Madame Web and decides that, you know, the X-Men have beat us countless times, you know, in the past, and we need an advantage over them. And maybe having our own personal psychic on our side can do just that. So they immediately, you know, head on a yacht. I'm not clear as to how they got one, but
well, I can tell you right now, the last thing I would be putting on a yacht would be the freaking Juggernaut. Okay, because. The first time we see the Juggernaut is him smashing through a door on the yacht, Black Tom Cassidy's headquarters room there or whatever, smashes the door. Now,
this was a missed opportunity, by the way. I'm not sure if you're about to make this joke. If you are, I apologize. Were you about to make a Kool-Aid joke?
No, I was not, but dang.
Okay. This was a missed opportunity. All they needed to do on the opposite page, I'm reading from the original comic, and you know, all Marvel comics in general are littered with ads. Some of them are fun, some of them are intrusive, but it's a missed opportunity to just stick a Kool-Aid ad on the opposite page.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Oh yeah.
Oh, that's the first thing I thought.
Juggernaut bust in. I would not put Juggernaut on a boat because the last thing I would need is him busting through something, and the next thing you know, the boat's on the bottom of the harbor or whatever.
Either that, or it also reminds me of like my favorite Friday the 13th drinking game, where like every time Jason Voorhees bursts through a wall instead of going through a door, which he easily could have done instead, you take a drink,
take a shot.
Yeah.
Oh man, we pretty much covered everything. We're starting to get into the story here, just like you were saying. We open up where Madame Web's having one of her visions, and she sees this, this monster coming after her, and there's only one person that she can think of that could possibly save her, and that's Peter Parker. So she reaches out to, or I should say Spider-Man, she reaches out to Peter Parker and says, hey, calls him in the middle of the morning, actually, says, okay, be prepared. I'm going to need your help today. Somebody's coming, and I'll be contacting you later. Now, Black Tom Cassidy, just like you said, has the brilliant idea to grab Madame Web, send his buddy, the unstoppable Juggernaut, to go get Madame Web. I mean, if you've got that heavy of a hitter, nobody's going to be able to do anything against. Why not? And Juggernaut's all for it. So, and you mentioned about how, you know, he wanted an advantage over the X-Men. And so we send the Juggernaut, who doesn't want to wait for the boat to be docked to get off the boat. He decides that it's a little bit quicker, which, number one, Kane Marco is not known for his smarts.
Nope.
And I don't think they meant for this to come across this way, but they just wanted to show how impatient and how single-minded and focused Juggernaut was. But Juggernaut hops off the boat and starts walking across the bottom of the ocean. So Juggernaut just starts walking towards land. Does not want to wait for the boat to anchor. He's on a mission, and he's heading that way. Peter Parker, we get a little bit of a side story here where he goes into the Daily Bugle, does his little check-in, and we get a phone call, and here it is, Madame Web again. And she tells him that Battery Park, be there at Battery Park, that's where he's coming out. And she hangs up on him. So Spider-Man's like, all right, heads over to Battery Park, and sure enough, out comes the Juggernaut straight from the water. Peter Parker is thinking that at one point, he has no idea who it is. He doesn't know who it's coming. It's not like Madame Web said, hey, Juggernaut's coming. She's just saying, hey, there's somebody coming for me, and I need your help, and I need you to stop him. So up to this point, I think Peter Parker's got all this stuff running through his head, like it might be the Submariner that's coming out, which he's a pretty powerful dude all in himself. He doesn't know who it is, and he's trying to find out who it could possibly be. So it isn't like he meets Juggernaut there as soon as he comes out of the water. He's trying to get over there as fast as he can until he finally starts seeing the damage that Juggernaut is doing as he's just walking. And it almost, dude, it's got to be like in a straight line.
You think about it, if you were that big and that strong and that dumb, and you were trying to get from point A to point B, would you bother doing anything except walking in a straight line?
When we say walking in a straight line, folks, I'm not talking about walking down the street in a straight line. I'm talking about through buildings, through traffic, just straight through getting from point A to point B with nothing stopping him. So Spider-Man finally sees who it is. Big brown dude walking, big dude in a brown suit walking down the road.
Spider-Man's, you know, usually the kind of the eternal optimist when it comes to, you know, what he can do and how he can beat his enemies. So the first thing he does is tries to, swing up behind him and try to knock his helmet off. Juggernaut's got this gigantic dome-shaped helmet covering his head. He does that and kicks him, you know, somewhere roughly where a normal human being's, upper back or the base of his neck would be. And he just kind of bounces off and goes flying in the opposite direction.
There's no reaction whatsoever from Juggernaut. I mean, you would think that Spider-Man coming down, hitting you right in the base of your neck or, you know, when your back's turned, doesn't move him. Juggernaut doesn't even turn his head to look his way. Just keeps going. So when you say that, you know, the aura butt flies to me, or what is, I can't remember the dude from what he says and what he says in Ghostbusters 2. Oh,
the buzzing of flies. You're like the buzzing of flies to me.
That's pretty much what it is. Juggernaut's just gone. Nothing. Nothing's affecting him. So that's interaction number one. Spider-Man tries to get down there, gets his attention, tries to do something to stop this guy. Nothing happens. I'm going to take number two here, where Spider-Man uses his web fluid to create a wall. Obviously, it's probably not going to be too hard to figure out where Juggernaut's going. All you got to do is just get something in front of him. Spider-Man creates this wall of webbing. You know, is it going to hold? Is it going to hold? I think that it does, but it's the walls that it was attached to that actually crumble. As the Juggernaut walks straight through the web wall, well, I would say through it, but he walks into it, it stretches, pulls whatever it was hooked to, plaster or whatever, brick, pulls it off of there, and then he just shrugs the webs off. Tries to make a pothole, so he'll go down into the ground. Juggernaut walks right into it, comes right back out. At this point, he's kind of getting Juggernaut's attention, but he is still, it's not like Juggernaut's starting to swing at Spider-Man or anything. He just continues to walk. And finally, well, at this next point, Spider-Man gets the brilliant idea to latch onto him.
Well, first of all, you know, he sort of tries to stand in his way and, you know, tries grabbing him, punching him, trying to get a hold of him. He doesn't move him at all, so he ends up stuck to his back. True to form, you know, as he has been so far, Juggernaut just decides to keep walking, and he continues walking through a wall. Only this time, Spider-Man's attached to him, and he walks through the wall with him in it, with him on top of him, and comes out the other side of the wall by himself. I want to be a little bit of a comic art geek about this page that we're talking about, because yeah. it's meant to be over four panels, like basically the same scene, like that, like he goes into the corner of one wall and walks out the corner of another one. That's all meant to be the same image divided into four panels. It's something that I always say, like whenever I'm on the show, I always, you know, get a little bit geeky about comic art and sequential storytelling.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, this is John Romita Jr. and also Jim Mooney who inked him and who probably finished a great deal of this artwork. This was still early in Romita's career when he wasn't doing full pencils. But, you know, the team, you know, the art team behind this just did a great job, and we'll see plenty more of it coming up. Of just, you know, imaginative stuff like this where you see, you know, using still images to, like, convey, you know, passing of time and passing of, you know, motion.
It didn't even occur to me. I mean, that is the same building pretty much. It just, I mean, it's all one building in that four panel spot. But the only thing that changes is the fact that, you know, Juggernaut walks in through the building, then comes out the other side without him on it, which I never even noticed that till you pointed it out. That's pretty freaking cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hop in there, man. When you see stuff like that, definitely let me know, because I like being shown stuff like that I totally miss. I don't pay enough attention to the art coming from the guy who started getting into comics because of Image and its art. I don't pay attention to stuff like that, or at least it doesn't catch my eye.
Yeah, but see, the best thing about stuff like that is once you see it for the first time, you're never going to unsee it again.
That's right. That's right. All right. So Spider-Man shrugged off. Well, he kind of, the building did its work and Spider-Man was left in there. We do get treated to, you know, hey, it's Spider-Man versus the Juggernaut. One of the things that you'll hear from people that talk about this story is the fact that this is one of the biggest fights or the biggest challenges that Spider-Man has had up to that point. This guy is he's a foe that kind of outclasses Spider-Man. He's almost in a different league. So you're probably thinking to yourself, well, you know, where is the X-Men? This guy's a villain of the X-Men. Why don't they pop in here? And Spider-Man is thinking the same thing. We find out that I think Fantastic Four are off into space. The X-Men are unavailable. I think Spider-Man even makes a stop by Doctor Strange's house. Doctor Strange is probably practicing Satanism in the North Pole like we saw in Civil War. Oh, <boy. laughs> No, I don't know where he's at, but he's not there. Wong answers, but pretty much what we find out is Spider-Man's all on his own.
I actually find it amusing that it's kind of an unintentional running gag that Madam Web can find him and call him on whatever phone he happens to be near.
Yeah.
Like she's got him low-jacked or something. Like,
yeah, she catches him as he's laying in that pile of rubble.
And later catches him at Doctor Strange's house, and he's not really, at this point, he's not surprised, and he actually says, you know, when the phone rings, he's like, nah, it's probably for me. I'll get it.
All right, so Juggernaut continues on his mission. He's heading over to Madame Web's apartment. You know, Spider-Man's trying to catch up with him. New York's finest is out there. Even some of the guys, they said that took on, what'd they say? They've took on the Hulk before. They've got sandbags ready for the Juggernaut, and they unload nothing. He just continues his walk. He continues his way, his walk of destruction, if you will, soldiering on towards the apartment. And he actually reaches the apartment, and he's walking up the stairs.
We see here, as in any good monster movie, you know, with a gigantic monster that may or may not be from Japan, the last resort of any, you know, any protagonist against the monster would be to use electricity. Mm-hmm. We've seen that used on Godzilla tons of times. It's really the only thing that ever seems to hurt him.
That's right.
So Spider-Man gets the bright idea once he finally gets to Madame Web's place, you know, seals off the door. It's a steel door, and he basically hooks one of her generators powering, you know, Madame Web is hooked up to all of this, you know, elaborate life support machinery that probably runs on tons of electricity. God only knows what her electric bill is. Like, but
she plays the lottery, I guarantee you. She ain't got to worry about none of that.
Yeah, well, she's psychic, so
that's right.
So yeah, Spider-Man gets the bright idea to wire her steel front door to one of her generators that's supposed to generate, I think, what did they say, like several million volts of electricity. I'm not sure how scientifically
21 gigawatts.
Yeah, that's what I thought. at least. So yeah, so Juggernaut, not particularly feeling threatened by this, just decides to punch through the door. The electricity maybe slows him down a little bit, but what it actually succeeds more in doing is blowing the generator, and then he comes through the door anyway. So that didn't work. So basically the one thing that can stop Godzilla has, you know, failed to stop the Juggernaut. Mm-hmm. But we're getting an idea of how impossible it seems to actually beat this guy, which is really important to see later on.
I mean, he's there. The Juggernaut is in the room. Spider-Man has thrown just about whatever he can at him, and Juggernaut is there. He came to get Madame Web. He is there in the same room with Madame Web as we speak. And Spider-Man is... It's almost like he is powerless to stop this guy.
He tries his best to fight him off, but really, trying to take Juggernaut one-on-one is really not going to happen. And he gets knocked out of the building, along with part of, I think, the side of the wall, something like that. You know, Juggernaut proceeds to, you know, grab Madame Web out of her chair and out of her, life support machinery. And she immediately starts going into convulsions. Apparently nobody told him or Black Tom that she can't really survive outside of all this machinery. So, you know, Spider-Man makes his way back into the building and tells him, you know, she's dying. She can't live without any of this stuff. Can't move her. So Juggernaut just kind of looks at her and is like, well, I wasted my time, and just kind of tosses her aside.
Jeez.
Which, if you didn't already hate him as a villain, you know, that kind of did it. He basically, like, you know, yanked an old lady off of life support. I mean,
oh,
how much more villainous can you possibly get?
I know. It's not like he lays her down gently either. You know, she's going into convulsions.
He
just drops her ass on the ground. She's laying there and she's convulsing, and, you know, Spider-Man has to run over there and start CPR, and finally the cops show up. Juggernaut's gone. You know, I'm sure you could probably still hear him in the distance, but he's on his way. It's almost like this fight was for nothing.
I got to point something out here that is one thing that I wanted to make a point of at the very end of the comic.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, basically the cliffhanger to this issue is Juggernaut's still on the loose. He's still, you know, gonna cause damage to anything that's in his way. He's still, you know, he's got to be stopped for nothing else because he's a danger to the city, but also because Madame Web's got to be avenged. That's kind of how Spider-Man looks at it. Also because, and this is the thing that pops up a lot in Spider-Man comics that I also don't necessarily like, and that is Peter's sort of sense of guilt.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that I wanted to talk about for a while. I'm not going to spend too much time talking about it, but I wanted to bring it up. this is something that they, to this day, in the current Spider-Man comics, they just keep coming back to, and that's Peter. One of Peter's, apparently, one of his favorite phrases, which is, "It's my fault. It's all my fault." Mm. Guilt is a big part of what's, you know, how Spider-Man came to be. Like, that's, you know, we've talked about his origin before and how, you know, he is sort of directly, indirectly, depending on how you look at it, responsible for the death of his uncle. It was a death he could have prevented, but he had no way of knowing that, you know, his preventing events previous would have prevented the death of his uncle. It's one of those things where it's like, if you can do good, then you have to. Otherwise, it's the sort of thing where, like, you know, evil prospers when good men do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big part of Spider-Man. That's a big thing that I love about the idea behind Spider-Man. But sometimes it kind of gets overblown, and this was a big thing that Roger Stern did, and this is a big thing that even to this day that Dan Slott does in the current Spider-Man comics, which is Peter kind of tends to assume guilt for everything.
Yeah.
I mean, everything. Just the fact that, you know, and this is just me playing, you know, like what I would have done, like how I would write and how I like to see Spider-Man portrayed. I don't necessarily like the sort of constant being motivated by guilt that a lot of people portray Spider-Man as. I kind of figure, you know, yes, you know, in the beginning, certainly Spider-Man was motivated by guilt. Of course he was. That's the whole point. But at a certain point, especially if you want to portray him as getting any older than beyond high school age, being motivated by guilt is really a terrible sort of motivation, especially when it comes to doing good.
Mm-hmm.
I never really liked that I never saw that as what Spider-Man is about, because motivation purely by guilt is to me motivation purely by self-interest and self, you know,
it's hollow.
Yeah. And not everybody necessarily portrays him like that. I've mentioned a couple of times to friends and online and stuff. One of my favorite scenes of any Spider-Man comic ever is actually the scene in Spider-Man, which is written by Brian Michael Bendis. You know, mainstream Marvel Universe, like 616 Spider-Man meets Ultimate Universe on May. Well, yeah, he meets Miles, but he also meets, there's a scene he meets Ultimate Universe on May.
That's right.
And there's a scene where, like, she's not, you know, she's not convinced that it's really him, and, you know, she doesn't necessarily believe that he's, you know, from another dimension, another universe. Peter Parker in the Ultimate Universe is already dead by this point, and she's, like, just totally still in grieving, and she sees this adult version of Peter from, you know, supposedly another universe. The way that Bendis kind of describes what Spider-Man does is one of my favorite depictions of what he does, and he says, "I do what I do because it's the way that I know my uncle would have done it if he were me, if he were in my shoes, if he had my power. I do it the way he would have done it." And then, you know, he says, "With great power," and she finishes the sentence and says, comes great responsibility." And that's how she knows. She says, "Oh my God, it really is you." That gets me every time. One, because it's a great scene. Two, because it's exactly like how I see Spider-Man. You know, I see, you know, at first it was about guilt. At this point, I feel like that could only take you so far. And at some point, it feels like it would be more about honor. But, you know, that's just one guy, you know, I'm just one guy. That's kind of the way I see it. Certainly, you know, Peter has this perpetual sense of guilt, and sometimes that leads to good stories and good decision making, and sometimes it doesn't. Honestly, in this case, this is a good example of where it leads to something good, because he kind of resolves to, "I'm going to stop the Juggernaut no matter what it takes." And at the last panel, he says, I'm going to stop him or die trying, which is totally Spider-Man to me. So it's kind of a mixed bag. It's just something that I wanted to get out there.
Well, let me tell you what I think the biggest thing that spoke to me in this whole two issue arc, other than the fact that it's a fun fight story. At the end of this first issue, I realized that Peter has just seen one of the biggest threats he's ever probably encountered run roughshod through New York, all the way to get to this apartment. He completely succeeded right in front of Spider-Man's eyes. This guy went up, grabbed an old lady, dropped her on the floor. He was powerless to do anything. Now, one of the big differences I thought about was how Uncle Ben, just like you said, it all comes back to the guilt that he felt for that, the guilt that he feels for Gwen Stacy. Uncle Ben was something that he had no clue was going to happen. Granted, he may have had a part in it. He may have, clearly, without his intervention, he could have saved his uncle. But he didn't know that was the way things were going to go down. Gwen Stacy, all the chaos that happened with her, she ends up dying. But he didn't. He had no idea about the threat that was coming. He just knew that he tried to save her. In this particular instant, he knew the juggernaut was coming. He was forewarned and told, this guy is coming. You need to stop him. And he could do nothing. And it's not like this guy was using tactics to try and stay hidden underneath Spider-Man's. And what's funny is I don't even know if his spider sense goes off at any point throughout these two books, because that's not a factor. This guy is going straight line. All you have to do is stop him from reaching that destination and causing whatever potential death or destruction that's going to result in what he's doing. And he can do nothing. No matter what he does, he can't stop the juggernaut. And at the end of this, even through all this crap that he just went through, just like you said, he, as Madam Web is being carted or going, she's in an ambulance going to the hospital. He has no idea if she's going to live or die. He says, bullshit. I'm stopping the juggernaut. I'm done. This guy is going to be stopped by my hand. Hence, that's what really made that poignant to me at the end, where he makes a decision because he doesn't have to. Really, as guilty as he feels, this guy already reached his goal. He could just let Juggernaut go back into the sea where he practically came from. another parallel to Godzilla.
Oh, yeah.
Just watch him go right back into the ocean. He could have done that. He didn't have to continue, but he has decided that no matter what the odds are, this has got to be resolved. So. Yeah.
Well, it's a little like the old mentality, the mentality they say, about anybody that does heroic things on a daily basis, your firefighters, your police, mm-hmm. Soldiers, everybody's running away from danger. Everybody's running out of the burning building. The firefighters are running into it. Cops and soldiers are running towards the gunfire.
That's right.
It takes.
Takes a hero.
It takes something special for that,
That's right. Go ahead and describe 229's cover and 230's cover, if you would.
229 kind of gives you, it's funny because it kind of gives away the ending of the comic, which is basically like Spider-Man kind of cradling Madam Web in all this rubble and sort of the silhouette of the juggernaut kind of towering over him and Spider-Man kind of having you'd figure his spider sense went off right about there.
Mm-hmm.
He's standing right behind him. And with the tagline, nothing can stop the juggernaut, which is also, the title of the first part of the story. The second part is, is this gigantic, it's a little artistic license, but it's this gigantic, scowling face of Juggernaut with this very tiny Spider-Man shown swinging directly towards him. Which, if you think about it, really tells you everything you need to know about, what's about to happen.
Yeah.
And the tagline there is, to fight the unbeatable foe. That says it all, really. I mean,
I'll tell you right now, if I was reading 229 and this was at my newsstand, and back in the 80s, I know you've heard stories about how it was, comic stores weren't hardly anything back then.
Right.
I would have probably tore my town apart to find 230 if I read 229.
Well, the thing is, back in the day, it was pretty well known, and this was a little, obviously this was the year I was born. It's been pretty well documented that, back in the newsstand days, if you missed that comic that month, you weren't finding it again.
Yeah.
Not for a long time. Not until comic book stores became a thing and back issues also became a thing.
Yeah.
So, if you missed the boat, when it came out, you were kind of,
And it wasn't a guarantee. I mean, that same store that you went to go pick up 229 was not guaranteed to show up as 230. The 230 was not there's a possibility it may not show up the next month.
Not necessarily, yeah.
It's crazy. True. All right. So, okay, we're getting into 230, our conclusion to the two-issue arc here. Pretty much pick up where we left off immediately. Spider-Man's decided to go after the Juggernaut. I like how, okay, his next step is they come across this construction, you know, basically there's some scaffolding and they're working on either fixing up this building or tearing it down, one or the other. And Spider-Man constructs a, what would you call this, a slingshot, I guess?
Pretty much.
Yeah, he constructs a slingshot, but just no, not an ordinary slingshot. One that shoots like 12-foot I-beams at people. And he shoots one at the Juggernaut, and the Juggernaut catches it and just crumbles it. So this guy's clearly powerful.
I don't know exactly how much a steel girder weighs, but I know, you know, it's easily enough to crush a normal human being.
Oh, yeah, so dude.
You get the sense, like... Like I said, there's some great storytelling being done here, both by, you know, by Roger Stern and by Romita Jr. with the art, of giving you an idea of how powerful Juggernaut is just by way of what he does and what Spider-Man tries to do to him and fails at. This issue is really where, like, he's throwing everything but the kitchen sink at him, and he's, you know, and he's just mostly just kind of shrugging it off, and, you know, that reaches fever pitch towards the end. But at this point, yeah, I think they make full use of this construction site and all the, you know, all the toys that there are there.
I mean, I can't say that there's too many in Spider-Man's rogues gallery that Spidey is throwing pieces of a building at. Or like in this next one where the Juggernaut's finally getting enough of him and decides to grab a part of the building that Spider-Man is on, knocking it down. But Spider-Man's lucky enough to get away to where he grabs a wrecking ball, swings it above his head, much like you'd see, but I guess...
Hammer throw.
Much like that, where he's just swinging it, and he lets it go. And this freaking wrecking ball is going right at Juggernaut's face. And Juggernaut just pop punches the wrecking ball to the side.
Leaves a gigantic dent in it.
It's insane, man. Juggernaut is just... I mean, I think he finally ends up putting part of the building... No, he doesn't do it. I think Juggernaut, with him slapping that wrecking ball, runs into the building, and the building... Okay, Spider-Sense, by the way. Yep. We do see Spider-Sense here, where the building is about to come down, and unfortunately, Spider-Man nor the Juggernaut are fast enough to get, like, completely out of the way. I think Spider-Man heads for these culverts or whatever and hops in one and is able to kind of survive or wait out the bricks from this building falling down on top of him. Unburies himself from the bricks and proceeds to find out that the Juggernaut has already got himself out. And again, you just see the line of, you know, of cleared bricks that that he just made as he's making his way back to wherever he's going.
I also like how sure that, you know, Spider-Man seems that, you know, like, you know, he brought a whole building down, but at least, you know, at least he got the Juggernaut. And then he gets out and some guy is like, you know, geez, both of them survived. He's like, wait a minute, what do you mean both of them? And Juggernaut's already gone, and he just looks so disappointed.
Gosh. The next move that Spider-Man does is pretty epic because he's out of web fluid and he's got to try and find a way to stop this guy who, again, it's like the Juggernaut always has his back to Spider-Man because he just doesn't care. He's done. He just wants to go back to where he came from, and Spider-Man is trying to stop. So what's the next thing Spidey decides to do?
Just kind of by accident, he kind of runs he runs into a truck driver who happens to be driving a fuel truck, a really big, like, fuel tanker. And after, you know, after kind of semi-threatening the driver and kind of scaring him off without actually hurting him, he makes quick work of a tire iron, which is kind of funny, which would scare anybody off.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
He realizes, he's like, wait a minute, this is a fuel truck, and he kind of gets this bright idea. And meanwhile, Juggernaut's just going on, you know, off on his way. You get a sense that they're closer to the pier, which Juggernaut's basically trying to just jump back into the river and, I guess, head back to Black Tom's boat. Spider-Man's trying to stop. He does him the courtesy of at least, like, honking the horn on the truck before, you know, when he comes through.
Get his attention.
This is another part where, like, you know, just the storytelling here is really, really cool. you know what's about to happen. Spider-Man's like driving this truck directly at him. Juggernaut does not move a muscle. He pretty much plants his feet and just, you know, and basically just calls his bluff and says, you know, I'm not moving. You want to hit me with this truck? If you think it's going to hurt me, go right ahead. Spider-Man ducks out of the truck and jumps and tries to get clear as far as he can, because he knows this is good. This is about to get really bad.
Yeah.
And then you see on this page, and this is one of the parts of the story that pretty much everybody remembers. And it's just this, the truck is like literally feet away from him and he doesn't move and he just stares it down. And the way that everything's set up, it's like, it's one of those things where it's another thing where I say, like, you know, the way panels are placed can be used to sort of manipulate time and the way you look at time passing. And it's just that split second before the truck hits him where he says, this won't hurt me, nothing can. And you just see the look on his face, like that moment immediately before impact. Mm-hmm. And then the truck hits him and it completely explodes in a gigantic fireball.
Oh my God.
Which takes up most of the rest of the page.
Yeah, that's it. You got to be thinking, okay, that's it. It's done. Finally, we've stopped the Juggernaut. And lo and behold, out of the fiery wreckage, much like a T-1000, that's the image I got when I read this book. I was like, Terminator 2 ripped this completely off. Because here, actually, Terminator 1, because I believe it happens in Terminator 1 also, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Where the truck explodes, which I'm curious now, which one came out first? I think this came out first.
This came out first, yeah. The first Terminator movie came out two years later.
Wow. Anyway, from the fiery wreckage, on walks the freaking Juggernaut, man.
This is the part where I always make the Simpsons joke. Like, if Robert Winfrey's listening to this, he's another fellow like Simpsons nerd. This is where I would make the joke where, you know, he's like some non giving up school guy. And if you've seen that episode, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And if not, go watch it. Because, yeah, at this point, Spider-Man, at first, he's freaking out and he's like, oh my God, I've killed him. And then he sees him getting out and he's like, oh, you can imagine the look under the mask. Like, you just got to be kidding me.
And he's on fire. I mean, it's not like Juggernaut is just coming out of this unscathed. He's walking towards Spider-Man on fire and just by luck accidentally kicks over a freaking hydrant that, you know, sprays him with water and puts out his own body. And at that point, it is at that point that Juggernaut is finally like, okay.
He's kind of sort of pissed off now. You had to drive a fuel truck into him to get a reaction, but now he's mad, which has got to be even worse.
He looks at Spider-Man and he says, Spider-Man, you're dead. Proceeds from there. Spider-Man attempts to, again, hop on him. I think at some point throughout this, he's figured out that if he can get the helmet off, he might have some kind of luck. He might have heard that from, I think that was a vulnerability that was exposed in some X-Men comics, if they could get the helmet off of him. However, that is all for naught. As Juggernaut knows better, he has welded his helmet onto his suit. So there
it is.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you put on the helmet. If it gets yanked off, well, why not weld it? So now it's welded to his suit, and Spider-Man, again, there's nothing he can do. There's a point where he latches on the Juggernaut's head, and I'm going to let you cover this. When he covers up his face, Juggernaut lets loose.
Spider-Man more or less tries to get Juggernaut in some kind of a headlock or some kind of like a chokehold, which is really hard to do when the guy you're trying to do it to has no neck. So he just kind of like is hanging on for dear life. And, you know, this is what a lot of people, you know, this is why a lot of people love this story so much, because and something similar to this, I know, has been done. I don't know if it was done before or after this story, but it was a battle that Spider-Man had with the Hulk, which he's had some run-ins where, you know, he can't beat him by physical strength. So he just kind of like completely out of ideas, just kind of jumps on him and hangs on for dear life because he can't think of anything better. And basically he sort of stands to reason that maybe the only thing that can hurt the Juggernaut is himself. So he kind of grabs onto him, and the Juggernaut's kind of like bashing himself in the head, trying to hit Spider-Man and hitting him sometimes and hitting himself too.
Yep.
And Spider-Man's getting the crap knocked out of him, but he's still hanging on. He refuses to let go because basically, like, this is the only way that he's got left that he can think of to maybe possibly hurt him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really working, but he's really out of ideas at this point.
Yeah, and I think, honestly, if I remember correctly, he lucks in to what happens next. It's completely by luck. They're in this construction zone, okay? You know, they're putting up this building, so there's this, I believe, a 40-foot deep pit of wet cement that Juggernaut just happened to walk on with Spider-Man, which is kind of funny. Spider-Man hanging on top of him and, you know, Juggernaut trying to pound Spider-Man off of him, probably proceeded to pound himself into this wet cement even further. But he starts to sink into this wet cement and his legs are stuck.
It's another subtle thing too. It's another, you know, subtle like art thing where the whole time that he's hanging on, you actually see him sort of sinking lower and lower in off the edge of the panel
yeah.
You know, as this series of panels goes on. And you don't really get that at that point until you get to the next panel after that and you realize, oh, wait a minute, and he actually says my legs are stuck.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really subtle thing. It's one of those things where it's like you don't notice it at that point, like right away, but you look back at it and it's like, oh, wait, the whole time he was sinking. And they didn't want to reveal why at the time.
Yeah,
until that moment, which is great. Which is great, great storytelling, especially in a comic where you can always jump ahead, you know, to see what happens next. But
yeah,
if you let the story, you know, if you let the story unfold one image at a time.
And this is not by Spider-Man's doing. I don't think he intended for this to happen in any way. He completely lucked out that covering Juggernaut's face led him into the cement pit. I don't, you know, Spider-Man didn't have any idea this was going to happen. He was holding on for dear life, hoping and praying that something would happen.
Yeah, he looks pretty surprised about it himself.
Yeah. And so Juggernaut proceeds to sink and continue to sink into the cement, all while yelling, you know, hey, this ain't going to stop me. This ain't going to stop me. Till finally, the last thing you see is yet another Terminator reference. One hand sticking up out of the cement, and as he continues to sink underneath it.
If he had given the thumbs up before he sank, then I would have known something is up. That'd be like, you know, James Cameron, you got some explaining to do.
Yes, sir. That's the end of our fight. As Juggernaut sinks underneath the cement, we finally believe that that's going to be it. The Juggernaut has been stopped, or at least he's not making his way out of that cement anytime soon.
Well, he figures, you know, Spider-Man just kind of figures, you know, this will at least slow you down long enough for, you know, other people to figure out a way to actually hold you or stop you.
Uh-huh.
It's a pretty good out, and you would think they covered all the bases. Basically, you know, it is true. You build big buildings and skyscrapers and tall buildings close to a waterfront where you presumably the ground is not as stable. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you're going to dig a deep foundation and you're going to pour a ton of cement to stabilize whatever building you're making. That makes sense. So, and then you figure, you know, a guy that can pretty much walk through and punch his way through just about anything. Well, maybe his one weakness would be something that he can't necessarily walk or punch his way out of.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, you've got this. So it's, in terms of, you know, being Juggernaut in a Spider-Man story, it's pretty, it's damn clever, I think. It's a way of beating him. I'd like to say it's one of those instances where, you know, where Spider-Man kind of outsmarts his opponent. But like I said, he seemed about as surprised that, you know, that they walked into this wet foundation as Juggernaut was. This is just more of an instance of where, you know, this is not necessarily an instance of, you know, outsmart the bad guy Spider-Man. This is never give up Spider-Man, which is just as cool and just as, you know, well-loved by, you know, by fans of his.
Uh-huh.
Where it's just like, you know, even if it kills me, I'm not gonna let go. I'm not gonna give up. I'm not gonna let you beat me without a fight. You know, and if I go down, I'm taking you with me.
Uh-huh.
That's, and, you know, that's that's why this story is so, you know, is so loved by so many people, because it's, and I've said this before, you know, anytime you've got Spider-Man, you know, standing up against impossible odds and, you know, and just saying, you know, bring it and bring it and bring it, I'm a happy guy, because that's what he is to me, and that's what he is to lots of other people.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Quick cleanup here, just to kind of, I want to make sure our listeners do know, Madame Web did live. However, she, I believe, lost her memory, or at least that's the way it seems.
At the end of this story, yeah.
Yes. And Peter Parker definitely looks worse for wear out of his suit. He looks like he got, it looks like he went up 1-1 with the Juggernaut. That's pretty much the end of our story here. Anything else you'd like to say, you know, to kind of, to wrap things up?
I do kind of like how it ends, where it's basically just Black Tom, like, watching the construction site from his boat and, you know, hoping that Juggernaut eventually comes out of there, and so far he hasn't, and he just keeps watching him.
Yeah. Now, I've got this, I did tell you, I wanted to talk about this Mighty Marvel power chart that we've got here that follows the story, has nothing to do with the story. I figured we'd just make a tiny little game out of this, and yeah. I think it's going to be real easy. So we've got this, the Mighty Marvel power chart, how Spider-Man stacks up against Marvel's most powerful superheroes. The game is me going to ask you who is more powerful. All right. Now, this is going to be completely easy. I guarantee it. However, once we get in the middle, I think it might be a little tough. Question number one, who is more powerful? When we say powerful, well, it does say most powerful. Who is more powerful, the Hulk or Spider-Man?
Well, that would be the Hulk.
That is correct. The Hulk has a strength level of limits unknown, according to this chart. All right.
Strong.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Comparing Spider-Man, who is more powerful, Spider-Man or Daredevil?
Spider-Man is more powerful.
That is correct. Daredevil has a strength level that can lift 300 pounds.
Which we talked, by the way, we talked about the death of Jean DeWolf earlier.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of Daredevil Spider-Man fight scenes in there, and yeah, Spider-Man kicks the crap out of him. So that's how.
Oh, really?
I know. Yeah.
I can't wait to read. All right, next up, Spider-Man up against the Thing. Who's more powerful?
That'd be the Thing, but considerably less than the Hulk.
That's correct. The Thing, power strength level, who can lift 85 tons? All right. This one might be a tough one. Spider-Man, Captain America. Who's more powerful?
See, this one tends to, I feel like it tends to vary a little bit depending on who's writing the story. But as far as the chart goes, and as far as raw, like, strength level goes, I want to say Spider-Man.
That's correct. Captain America apparently has a strength level of 800 pounds. Super soldier serum, doing him good. All right. Spider-Man and the Vision. Who's more powerful? That's almost like you wouldn't compare those two. It'd just be so weird, because when I think of the Vision, I certainly do not think strength. That's not what I, you know, that's not normal. Of course, I haven't read too many stories with the Vision, so please spare me your vitriol, Josh Galandros and the West Coast Avengers. But I don't know much about the Vision, but what I've seen, I've never seen the guy, like, physically throw down. And I've yet to see Civil War, so I don't know much about what he does in there either.
What, the movie?
The movie, so I don't know if
Oh, man, you haven't seen that yet?
No, dude, this week, I'm on vacation. I'm starting with Deadpool, and then I'm going to go to Civil War, and then I've got to go to Batman versus Superman, the ultimate cut. And there's another one in there I think I've got to watch, too. There's another comic book movie, I swear, that was released, but I can't remember. But anyway, yeah, dude, I've got to catch up, so...
Well, in regards to, you know, who's more powerful, I'll probably just go with Vision, because he's an android.
You are correct.
Yeah.
The Vision is 6'2", weight 500 pounds, strength level 50 tons.
Dude, this is how you can tell Paul Bettany's a good actor, like, who plays the Vision, because if you've seen him in real life, he looks like he weighs about 90 pounds, so.
All right, last one. Spider-Man, Luke Cage. Power Man versus Spider-Man.
Let's say Spider-Man.
That is correct. Spider-Man. Yeah. Spider-Man coming in at 5'10", 165 pounds, strength level of 10 tons. Luke Cage, 6'3", 325, strength level 3 tons. So there you go, folks. There's your mighty Marvel power chart. Nice little bonus in the back of this, or in the middle of this thing.
I have a good idea about these because, and if anybody, this was another staple of the early 90s.
I know where you're going to.
I collected the trading cards.
That's right. I'm going to be, I think it's on next, it's going to be coming up next week. I'll be sharing this, but I had the opportunity to go do Marvel trivia at one of the guys, the comic shop down here. They had a podcast. They do a podcast called the Kapow Podcast. And one of the questions was, what is the force that gives Silver Surfer his powers? And Jordan, the comic shop owner, goes on a rant for probably a good 3 or 4 minutes about how those cards back in the 90s had him at a power level 7 when he has the power cosmic. And he was like, it's just so wrong. There's no way. You can't have the power cosmic and have a power level of 7. But yes, you talk about the cards. What do you remember specifically which set you got or what you were collecting?
I got the first series through the fourth one, but I never collected all, and I was never able to collect all of them.
Oh man.
This was before I was living in Florida, where I had much easier access to Walmart, where I would have been able to get the whole box of the whole set.
Oh jeez.
That would have been much easier. But yeah, when the first like one or two series of those cards, man, we trade, that was currency in like second and third grade for me. We traded those for sandwiches. We traded those for like, you know, for school supplies. We traded them for like, you know, all kinds of stuff. But,
man,
those were some good times.
I hear you, dude. Cause I had a few of those cards. I, just like you said, that rings true 90s to me. Cause I was reading, I can remember specifically having my issue of like Max number 2 or 3, the Max, and having bought some of those cards and looking those over. There was an auction up here, just right down the road here, and a guy had, there had to have been 15 to 20 albums of nothing but trading cards from the 90s, including stuff like that, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cards, Alf. I mean, I'm talking stuff that would just, you forgot was even around back then. And those cards were something else. Cause you talk, you looked at those cards and you analyzed it. It was just like a baseball card. You looked at the ERA or ERA. Yeah. ERA or the RBA, RBI. Boy, I know my baseball, don't I?
It's late.
It's been a while, but you know, you looked those over and I still got some, dude, right in the same case back there with my Garbage Pail Kids.
I have no idea what happened. I'd like to think that I kept at least one series of those damn cards because, man, I spent enough time buying them, but I can't remember where the hell any of them are.
I'll have to pull those out and we'll maybe throw some of those up on Facebook here. I'll tag you in some of them. Cause yeah. Man, they, like you had, not only did you have just each character, you had like famous fights. I remember specifically Daredevil versus Punisher was one of my favorite ones. I was like, oh, look at this. It's going to go down. There were some really cool cards in there, but one of the
series one, Stan Lee had his own card.
So that's right, dude. I remember that. And they had, the thing is that they didn't really, I don't think they did different art on each card. It was the same artist. I think they were all the same, weren't they?
Not entirely, like, as far as, like, each series?
No, not each series. I'm talking about, like, for, like, one series. If I remember right, I think series one or series two, it almost looked cartoony.
Well, they had a lot of the comic. They had a lot of the whoever was drawing the comic at the time did a lot of the art for the trading cards. Because I know series two and three, Eric Larson did the Spider-Man card.
Oh, really? I'm going to have to pull them out then again, because maybe I'm...
I know that for a fact, just because there's no mistaking Eric Larson's
Spider-Man. No, there is not. So. You know it when you see it.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, if you've got anything else to say here on this particular... Let me start first. Let me start first, and if you want to follow up with anything, great. This is the first time I've ever read this story, by the way. So when I got this from the library, I know I've seen the cover, but I've never read the story itself. And I really enjoyed it. The art, hey, it's John Romita Jr., which it's so different from what I was used to when we did Daredevil. You know, it's got to be the anchor that made the difference, and things look so different comparing this to that. And of course, what we've got a total of 10 years of experience in between each one, between both stories. So, but yeah, I love the art. It's a great story. It's fun to see these guys, Spider-Man up against one of the most powerful foes coming from a totally different comic book. So it's enjoyable. Anybody out there that's wanting to pick it up, we sit here and we tell the story, but we can't do comics justice without you being able to see them. So even though we may spoil the story for you, you need to hold this in your hands, or you need to find it online if you can, or do something to actually enjoy it with your own eyes, because that's the one part about this podcast that really, as much spoiling as we do in particular stories, that part we cannot do. We cannot spoil for you. You have to be able to see it with your own eyes in order to be able to enjoy it. Yeah, great story, man. Great two-story arc. What do you got to say?
Yeah, just like you said, if you're interested, definitely check it out. It's considered by most Spider-Man fans to be one of the best, and it's some, you know, depending who you ask, you know, the best Spider-Man story. Certainly one of the ones that kind of nails what his character's all about, as far as, you know, like, you know, never say die, never give up, even if the odds are impossible and overwhelming, just, you know, stand your ground and fight the good fight, which is why it's kind of stood the test of time over the past, you know, this many years. It's available in trade paperback form, not just in the Wizard collection that you have, but there's a separate collection called, you know, specifically called Nothing Can Stop the Juggernaut. It collects issues 224 through 230. The cover is basically the cover to issue 230 of, you know, gigantic, you know, Juggernaut and Spider-Man swinging towards him. It's, you know, pretty hard to miss on the shelf at your local comic book store. It's available on Amazon, and it may be available digitally. I'm not too entirely sure about that, but, you know, if you're interested, you can always look that up too. Yeah, check that out. This was good. This was a pleasant surprise to find out that, you know, that my birthday comic was not just kind of a throwaway story that nobody remembers, that it's actually an iconic one, and it's also was one that was done by one of my favorite artists and one of my biggest influences as an artist. That's really cool. It led to a cool experience that I have a really cool story to tell from it. Just good stuff all around. This is a good way to kick off, you know, my birthday week next week. So
awesome. Yeah, happy birthday, man. And I am honored to have the privilege to sit here and talk to you about this particular story and actually put it on my podcast. That means a lot to me. So I can't thank you enough. Let's go ahead. I guess we'll get into plugs unless you got something else you want to say.
I think I've said my piece.
All right.
Just check it out. It's a great story.
Very cool.
Yeah, as always, as ever, I write, draw, self-publish a comic called Soul Exodus. You can find it on my website, soulexo.com, or on my Facebook page, facebook.com/soulexo, or through Twitter, @soulexocomic. I also post my Sketchbook Saturday sketches, which by the time this hits, there will have been a new one. I do at least one every Saturday. Last week it was Rick and Morty that actually got a good reaction from everybody.
Wubba dub dub.
Yeah. It's basically, you know, it's whatever comes to mind in that moment. So who knows what'll come to mind tomorrow or the Saturday after that or Saturday after that. Not only that, check out drivethroughcomics.com. If you are into digital comics, check out drivethroughcomics.com. Most of my Soul Exodus collection is available digitally on that website. You can download them for an affordable price. They're huge, 100 plus, in some cases 200 plus page graphic novels that you can download digitally on for your mobile device for a fraction of the physical copy cost, if that is what you're into. Check that out. I'm still doing commissions. I'm still doing sketch covers. I'm trying to do as many as I can. I may or may not make Sketch Cover Sunday a thing. We'll see what happens, but I'm doing more of those. I just got a new Judge Dredd cover that should be seeing the light of day soon.
Ooh, nice.
I picked up Han Solo number one, which had a blank cover, which I'll probably be doing one of those soon, too. I'm trying to do as many of those as I can, because eventually I'm going to have to sell them all.
Yeah.
So all of them must go either now or at New York Comic Con. So make my load lighter between then and now. Why don't you?
Yeah.
And, you know, I mentioned it earlier and I'll mention it again. Shout out to Made of Fail podcast, madeoffail.net. They're a really awesome and incredible bunch of people that, you know, were nice enough to, you know, to let me guest on their podcast a couple of times. I've done artwork for them. They're always super appreciative of them. I consider them also, you know, friends of mine. In particular, thanks to Dana and George for hosting the episode that I appeared on, that, you know, who gave me the idea to look up this comic as, you know, the comic on the month and year that I was born and led to all of this stuff up to and including this very podcast that we're speaking on right now.
Awesome. Very cool. All right. Well, anything else, man? I mean, is that it?
I think we're good for now, but, you know, I may be back. If you want to talk Death of Jean DeWolf at any point, I may be back for that, because that may be that's one that I also have a great fondness for, and it's another one that's considered one of the best Spider-Man comics of all time. One thing I will mention, I'm gonna embarrass you a little bit, Jesse. How are you enjoying that Punisher comic?
Oh, dude, I have told many. I wish I could show you how many messages I sent to everybody. Like, look at this. It ain't coming out. I can tell you right now, it's probably not going to come out. I don't care what shape it's in or whatever. It's probably not going to come out of that plastic at all. And the fact that you sent me photos of him signing it and holding it up, dude, yeah. I could not wipe the smile from my own face.
I'll clarify for anybody that's listening. I was at MegaCon in Orlando, Florida a couple of weeks ago, and I met Mike Zeck, who is the artist of many, you know, great comics throughout the 80s and beyond. He was the artist for Kraven's Last Hunt, which we may also get to at some point, I think.
Well, it will happen.
At some point, I'm going to talk on this show about every Spider-Man comic ever made. But he also drew the very first Punisher miniseries. So,
right.
Yeah, I got a copy of Punisher number 4. It was the one that I found that was the least damaged. And, you know, yeah, I got Mike Zeck to sign it. I took a picture and passed it along to Jesse, and just consider that a thank you for the Superman comic.
Oh, man. I tell you right now, when I pulled that out of the envelope, you know, I'm showing my wife, and I said, you wouldn't believe this. Now, Mindy she doesn't know Mike Zeck from Mike Wachowski. But, you know, I'm like, no, you got to look at this. There is a picture of him signing it on the back. Now, listeners out there if you guys are just tuning in, that not only has, you know, Benjamin gone the extra mile here, and not only did he get a signed issue from Mike Zeck, but this was my first podcast. If you go back and listen to Source Material number 1, I did coverage of that miniseries from of the Punisher. It was Punisher Circle of Blood, if I remember correctly. I was looking at the trade paperback, and that was the first one I did, because that was the first graphic novel that I ever bought. Now, here's the thing, Benjamin. And I know I didn't tell you this I don't think I did. Maybe I did. I don't know. But I don't own a single issue from that miniseries. Not one. I have the trade paperback, and I've never seen or held in my hands an issue of that miniseries at all. And to open that up and see that signed by Mike Zeck was just, I can't put words to describe it out there, because it's just freaking awesome. That's probably about the best I'm going to do. I'm a simple man. Freaking awesome is about the best you're going to get from me, because that is seriously what it is. And it means a lot, man. Yeah, I shared pictures with everybody I know. I sent it to my buddy Dave, Golden Age Dave, and I it's going to be a treasured piece amongst my comic books. So it means a lot, man. Again, well, thank you.
This is something, you know, something I say to as many people as I can, and something that I try to live by, which is make friends through art.
So that's right.
That's what that's about. And that's all.
That's all right. That's all right.
Okay, that does it. I hope you all enjoyed Benjamin and myself as we conversated about Nothing Can Stop the Juggernaut. I want to thank you all for tuning in, and again, thanks to Benjamin for coming on, as it was a tremendous privilege. All right, as for Source Material's next show, it should be in 2 weeks, and the topic of discussion will be a 1990s classic, DC vs. Marvel. We're actually on the 20th anniversary of that particular crossover, so it should be a fun discussion. So until then, everybody, have a good one!